Hey, look, it's Friday. We'll wrap up the week that was. We will file another story about our economic poll, and we will explain how we are going to spend $7 billion on Halloween. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 30th of October. Great, as always, to have you along for the ride, everybody. It has been a busier macroeconomic week than one might have thought when one woke up on Monday morning. A week ripe, I would say, for a little bit of analysis on live radio. So that's what we're going to do. David Gura is at Bloomberg. Catherine Rempel is at The Washington Post. Hey, everybody.
Hey, Kai.
All right, so let's, I feel obliged, like I feel some fiduciary duty to give a nod to Janet Yellen here, Catherine and the Fed. Not, obviously, they didn't really do anything. What does it mean for the next meeting? And let's blow by this one quickly because there's not a lot to say, right?
I think that people are still unclear about what's going to happen in the next meeting. I've gotten a lot of notes from economic analysts this week saying, well, obviously this means that in December they're going to raise rates. And other ones have said, obviously this means they're not going to. I think basically, as we've been doing for the last few months, we should be watching the data, looking at the jobs report, and that might provide some greater clarity.
Mr. Gura, my friend?
Yeah, I actually, before I left here, Bloomberg, among other things, collects a lot of data, and one is a survey
yes,
of what economists are saying about when this raise might take place. So in that survey of economists, 50% and even 50% are saying that will happen in December. But, you know, I think they're going into this meeting. It was funny to watch sort of the consensus sort of taper off. People were pretty much convinced by the end that nothing was going to happen at this one. And I think that's starting to happen for the December meeting as well.
All right, there you go. Fed in 45 seconds. Boom, done. Let us move on to Washington, D.C. We are going to have... a little bit later in the broadcast, a spot by Andy Euler on what the deal might mean just in terms of going forward. But let me talk about the big thing that's on the table, one would think, with Paul Ryan in the speaker's chair, tax reform. Catherine, what do you think the odds are that now in the next, I don't know, 18 months or so, something actually substantive happens on this thing that's been 35 years in the waiting?
Don't know.
All right, then. Thanks very much, Catherine. I'm Washington Post.
I think that there's a lot of appetite for doing something on taxes. We have a very screwed up tax code, both on the personal income tax side and the corporate income tax side. And Democrats and Republicans think we should fix it and we should simplify it. But a lot of the things that are that economists would say are no-brainers are still politically super difficult, not to mention that things that reasonable people can disagree on also, you know, exist.
Are disagreed on, yeah.
Are disagreed on, exactly. So, you know, in my heart of hearts, I hope that there is something that comes through in the next 18 months. But you may also see, in addition to the usual barriers for tax reform, just this kind of waiting game until we get a new president.
David, it's worth a note here. Before you went to Bloomberg, you were in Washington for us. You covered this stuff in and out on the Hill. What do you think?
You know, Paul Ryan got up there and gave a very good speech calling for a lot of togetherness, calling for a lot of change to the culture on Capitol Hill. It was... could be construed as inspiring. One would hope that maybe some of those representatives took that to heart. But, you know, the climate there still is very difficult. I will say this two-year deal strikes me as something notable. As you say, having covered Washington for such a long time, I really think that 2 years seems like a very long time in light of some of the deals that we've had before. So, you know, I suppose there's a chance that he could get to tax reform, something he's talked about wanting to do for a very long time. We saw this week floated another really big pharmaceutical merger driven by the prospect of moving a tax base overseas.
Yeah.
Again, that's something that gins up a lot of conversation about tax reform. So maybe it'll happen.
All right. Catherine, last topic of the day is we're back to the Fed, but not on monetary policy, on regulatory policy. They came out today with some new rules about the big banks and how, in theory, we're going to be able to wind them down if something bad happens. It's all about issuing some debt and taking care of capital requirements. Are we safer now than we were 6 years ago?
Well, the rule hasn't gone into effect.
It's a proposal,
yet,
right? Exactly.
It's a proposed rule, and this is one among many steps that have been taken to try to buffer taxpayers actually from being on the hook for bailing out these banks. You know, I think in some ways we've guarded against what happened in the previous financial crisis. And in some ways, we've moved in the opposite direction in that there's so much more skepticism on the part of the American public about interventions in saving banks, even though, you know, most economists you'll talk to will say that was necessary. That's, you know, the bailouts were responsible for saving us from going into another Great Depression. But there's so much, again, political ill will towards that, that no matter how many rules you pass, no matter how robust your living will is, I do wonder whether the politics would get in the way next time.
As always, David Gura from Bloomberg, right? Come on, right? The politics
always.
Get in the way. David Gura at Bloomberg and Catherine Pell at The Washington Post. Thanks, you guys.
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks, Kai.
All right. Have a good weekend. Wall Street today was kind of touch and go, actually, till the end. And then traders, they said the heck with it. They sold off into the weekend. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. The corporate story of this Friday, and really of the past week or 10 days or so, is a drug company called Valeant Pharmaceuticals. It became a Wall Street darling through a high-profit strategy built on buying up other drug companies, laying people off, and then raising prices on their products, in a couple of cases, by several hundred percent. In the last year alone, its share price had tripled. Now, though, its business strategy has become more public. The stock price is way down, and hedge funds that are big stakeholders are defending their investments. All the while, Valeant is facing investigations and allegations of artificially boosting sales figures. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman unpacks this one.
The prescription drug business, it's a tangled web. There are drug makers, like Valeant, selling their drugs to pharmacy benefit managers, insurers, drugstores.
It's very complicated. This is the hidden underbelly of how the drug system works.
J.B. Silvers is professor of healthcare finance at Case Western Reserve. He says Valeant's been using every tool available to push its drugs out at the highest price.
What you see here, I think, is an exploitation of what I call a market imperfection. We have the illusion that drugs are a competitive business and that competition is good enough to drive prices down to some sort of fair rate.
But for a lot of drugs, there isn't much competition, like older brand name drugs that never got a competitor, or they're still under patent, so there's no cheap generic.
Wall Street-driven money, hedge funds largely, are going in there and saying, hey, there's a lot of money on the table. Go buy that drug, jack up the price. You can understand the business strategy. It's just not very socially responsible.
As Valeant's business practices and mounting legal problems become known, it is being punished on Wall Street. Cornell law professor Lynn Stout is author of The Shareholder Value Myth.
Surely they must have known that at some point there would be pushback. But the reality is the hedge fund industry has been very profitable by following these sorts of strategies. Buy, do everything you can to get the share price up, and then sell and get out.
Though with Valeant shares now on the skids, for some investors, it might be too late. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
As David and Catherine and I were talking about as we got going today, there is a budget deal in Washington and a debt limit deal. So we are going to be spared threats of government shutdowns and defaults on our debt all the way clear to 2017, which makes this, in all likelihood, the very last budget showdown between the Obama administration and the 114th Congress. The era of good feelings redux, then, for the history majors among you? Well, not quite, but at the very least, both the public and private sectors can count on a touch of certainty. Marketplace's Andy Euler explains how that might play out.
One upshot of the deal? If you're an everyday government employee, at least for now, you're not going to wake up one morning and find that you're on unpaid leave. If you're a civil electrician for the U.S. Navy like Milton Rowe, the implications are a little bit bigger.
These guys need us to be there for them, so that they have the lights on the boat. You know, they have power to the ships, the planes get launched, the hangars are working, they have the right tools and gear.
Rose getting to go to work every day speaks to just how vast the government's reach is, whether it's an electrician working for the military or a ranger at national parks. Rose says if nothing else, this deal makes him feel like he and the other 4 million federal government employees matter.
Now I know that the government, you know, maybe kind of cares about me as a federal employee, because at times you think, you know, that the government doesn't really look at federal employees as valued assets.
It's such a bad thing to close down the government because it makes the federal government look like they can't govern. and people lose confidence in government. And in the long run, that's very important.
Ron Haskins, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution, says the deal is also important for businesses. It allows us to not worry about defaulting on the nation's debt until at least March of 2017.
The biggest fear of business is that we're somehow going to damage the nation's credit. So I think business would be plenty satisfied.
Haskins says the deal gives us a couple years of stability, but it doesn't address the nation's underlying fiscal problems. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
If you've been listening to the show pretty consistently this week, you know we released the results of our first national economic survey on Monday, the Marketplace Edison Research poll. And honestly, it's been pretty grim. There's a whole lot of anxiety out there about paying bills, about getting or keeping jobs, about whether or not there is opportunity. There is, though, something else in there. Optimism, a lot of it, actually, and a belief that hard work will help you get ahead in this country. From Washington, Marketplace's Kimberly Adams takes it from there.
When I arrived at All Nations Baptist Church at the intersection of two busy streets in D.C., they thought I was coming for the job fair they were hosting.
Thanks, sir.
Hi.
How are you?
Fine.
Good luck to you downstairs.
Thank you.
All right.
The woman greeting me was holding a big, brightly colored sign trying to encourage passersby to come in.
I'm Lisa Robinson. I will be 51 November the 18th. Yay!
Robinson is the embodiment of optimism, and she says there's a good reason for her sunny outlook.
I remember being homeless. I remember being unemployed and unemployable.
Now she's living in transitional housing and has a job working with seniors. Robinson credits her church and hard work.
Being able to stand on your feet and to have people trust you all over again was hard. Going for your education, you had to do that. That was hard.
Our poll asked people what matters more in determining someone's financial situation, luck or hard work. Almost 80% said hard work is what makes the difference. It's optimistic, but not necessarily accurate.
It isn't just hard work. Hard work is necessary in most cases for success. It's not by itself enough for success.
Robert Frank is a professor of economics at Cornell University.
It's much less likely that you'll move up, even if you work hard and are talented now, if you start off from a lower point in the income distribution. Moving ahead has gotten more difficult than at any point in recent history.
That sentiment is echoed in the job fair in the basement of All Nations Baptist Church.
D.C. Army? No, Fire Department. Fire Department. Glad to have you.
Everyone I asked there, job seekers and recruiters alike, said hard work is the key to success. But some, like 27-year-old Greg Cooper, said luck definitely plays a role.
A lot of it is who you know, circumstances you're born into, socioeconomic status, a number of things, where you live, stuff like that.
Cooper was manning a table for a university nutrition program. He answered yes when I asked him another of our poll questions. Is his financial situation causing him to lose sleep?
Yeah, my financial situation sucks. I don't even know how much I owe. A lot. I think I owe like $50,000 in student loans. This area is expensive. Just bills, healthcare, all that stuff is expensive. So, yeah, I lose a lot of sleep.
As do a quarter of Americans worried about their finances. But more than 70% still say they feel they have a fair opportunity to achieve the life they hope for. Cornell's Robert Frank says that kind of attitude often pushes people to make their own luck.
If you tilt toward optimism, that's going to make you more inclined to put out effort when you think you have a chance than you'd be likely to do if you thought things were stacked completely against you.
Back on the corner outside the job fair, Lisa Robinson says she definitely feels she has a fair shot. She has two daughters and six grandkids and doesn't want them or anyone else using their difficult circumstances as an excuse.
It's all here for us. You know, we just got to apply ourselves.
She says now that she's in a better place, she's ready to give back. And so she waves her sign at the cars passing by. In Washington, I'm Kimberly Adams for Marketplace.
Just a reminder here that we are going to be doing this poll three more times before Election Day to help refine our understanding of what it is that y'all are thinking about economy-wise as you get ready to vote. If you want to see all the data we gathered, we've got that for you, of course, at our website. And there is a place for you to tell us how your economy feels to you, which is what this whole thing is about. It's marketplace.org. Coming up,
there's going to be a lot of Donald Trumps out there come Halloween night.
Trick or treat. But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrials lost 92 points, about a half percent, closed at 17,663. The NASDAQ down 20 points, 0.4%, 5,053. The S&P 500 dipped 10 points, a half percent, 2,079. There for the week, the Dow up 0.1%, the NASDAQ gained 0.4%. The S&P 500 rose 0.2%. Energy stocks had a good day. ExxonMobil bubbled up 0.6% as its third quarter results beat expectations. Chevron up 1.1%. In healthcare stocks, drug maker AbbVie vaulted 10% higher as profits beat expectations. U.S. listed shares of Valeant Pharmaceuticals off 17.2%. That's the company Mitchell Hartman was telling you about. It furthers recent losses, which I was telling you about as I set up that piece. You are listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Just because this is the way American capitalism works, the retail sector is already done with Halloween. No, I know we haven't even had it yet, but they have moved on to Thanksgiving and Black Friday. After a rising level of frenzy that saw stores opening on Thanksgiving night before the turkey was even done, some retailers, most notably REI, have said enough is enough. They're going to skip Black Friday altogether this year. Marketplace's Sabri Benishour has more on how the retail times, they are a-changing.
Black Friday has actually changed a lot in the 60-plus years it's been around.
I've been in retail for 30 years, and I remember a time when, you know, Black Friday was not a discount-driven holiday.
This is John Talbot, professor at the Kelly School of Business. He says retailers don't make a ton of profit on Black Friday, but they do make a lot of sales, up to 30% of the whole month. And stopping would look really bad on paper.
It's almost like a drug that they can't get off. In a way, they have to keep the Black Friday thing going because they're up against it from the previous year.
But in one sense, retailers have moved away from Black Friday as a day.
During the 2014 holiday season, we noticed that every day was Black Friday and every day was Cyber Monday.
Kathy Allen is with the National Retail Federation. Part of this has to do with online sales, which are growing 2.5 times faster than in-store sales, according to eMarketer. Yuri Wormser is a retail analyst there.
A lot of retailers are trying to get ahead of Black Friday with online deals on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, before Thanksgiving and then Thanksgiving Day itself.
These days, people can go straight from carving up their turkey to shopping on the couch on their phones. Candace Corlett is president of WSL Strategic Retail.
The Black Friday concept is very valuable. The Black Friday day, far less valuable.
The concept being, okay, it's holiday shopping time, let's have some promotions. So less Black Friday, more like beige Thursday, Friday, Saturday, Sunday, and on the internet day. In New York, I'm Sabri Benishour for Marketplace.
Halloween, as I alluded to a minute ago, is tomorrow, which means time is running out for you to make your contribution to what the National Retail Federation predicts will be the $6.9 billion we are collectively going to spend on Halloween this year. That is a nice-sized economy, which arrives every year often in bits and pieces. No doubt you have seen those temporary outlets that mysteriously appear in otherwise empty storefronts or shopping centers near you, walls packed with costumes and paraphernalia. And then they disappear just as quickly. Seems like a topic tailor-made for our series, I've Always Wondered.
If you wonder...
By asking 1,000 questions to get one answer. By brain work and blade work.
Hi, I'm Derek Trent from Dillsburg, Pennsylvania. And I've always wondered, how do Halloween pop-up stores work?
Marketplace's Mark Garrison is on it.
We're inside the perpetually loud, bright environment that is Ricky's NYC, an iconic beauty store with dozens of locations around the city. This time of year, it grows, opening up a dozen pop-up stores specializing in Halloween costumes. Sherry Auth is shopping for her 3.5-year-old daughter, a fan of the sneaky animated critters from the Despicable Me movies.
So I saw the Minion goggles and the Minion little yellow chapeau.
Sold. She also throws in some glow sticks, of course.
Thank you so much.
It's early in the day, and staffers are ringing up customers and restocking the shelves. Ricky's hires nearly 200 seasonal employees for Halloween. The place is packed with everything needed to become a monster, mummy, superhero, or space alien. Star Wars is red hot this year. Ricky's president, Richard Parrott, shows off the selection.
Of course, there's a lot of new characters, especially the stormtroopers. You have different looks that you've never seen before. And again,
he's not the Ricky the store is named after, but he totally looks the part. He's got a killer multicolored manicure and is getting his hair dyed red later. Parrott says Halloween provides about 10% of yearly sales, and data he gets from pop-ups give him insight on customers and potential new permanent locations, not to mention fantastic publicity.
It's just such great PR, and I'm on TV, I'm on the internet, I'm having a great radio interview right now with Marketplace. So as a growth tool and as a customer acquisition tool, it's really something you can't buy or manufacture. So it has an incredible value to our brand equity.
Running a pop-up store is a way to make more money off Halloween hype without having to cram year-round stores with costumes. Other companies are just in the business of Halloween. Places like Halloween City, Halloween Express, and Spirit Halloween. It's a big business. Spirit alone runs 1,100 seasonal stores in North America, including this one on New York's Upper West Side. I met Lynn Segallen out on the sidewalk. She's a Columbia Business School real estate professor who lives nearby.
What was in this space before as a Halloween store?
I can't remember. That's the funny part. Everything changes in New York.
Halloween retailers can often get good short-term deals. It's not that they're renting sketchy spots. Both these spaces are on busy streets in prime neighborhoods. Outside of cities, they tend to be in shopping centers with heavy traffic. That's the funny thing about commercial real estate. You expect storefronts to be vacant when the real estate market is weak, but sometimes they're empty when the market is hot.
There's a term in real estate called optionality, and quite simply it means if I rent today, I won't be able to rent tomorrow. So with leases that are 5, 7, 10, or 15 years long, if you rent what a landlord thinks is too early, you'll miss maybe higher prices later on.
In many cases, vacant spaces have plenty of tenants who want in, but landlords are betting on prices to rise, keeping stores empty. Renting to a Halloween store lets them make some money without getting locked in at today's price.
It gives landlords a chance to wait out the market, and it's always better to have something in a store than to have a vacant storefront. It's also important for the tenants because a lot of these seasonal stores couldn't make it if they had to rent for a long period of time. So it's, you know, it's a kind of temporary accommodation that has the potential to work for both sides.
We took a look inside, and browsing all the cheesy costumes with a real estate professor, I had to ask about a certain real estate guy turned politician who's a wildly popular Halloween costume right now. So what do you have as far as Donald Trump costumes?
Well, right now, not too much of anything.
Vince Pape is Spirit's district sales manager.
I think we have some of his Make America Great hats left, but we've sold out of all of the wigs. There's going to be a lot of Donald Trumps out there come Halloween night.
An army of drunken Trumps haunting your streets. Fittingly, it's all made possible by the spooky world of real estate. In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
This series only works if you've got things you have always wondered about. Send them along. We will answer them, get them on the radio. Maybe there's a spot you can do that at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, two media items worth a mention. No matter where you come down on CNBC's Republican debate Wednesday night, it was, if not quite must-see TV, certainly interesting. Anyway, Rens Priebus, the head of the Republican National Committee, did not think so, though. He sent a letter to the head of NBC News this afternoon saying the RNC is suspending its participation in a February debate scheduled to air on NBC. CNBC announced record for them ratings and revenues ad revenues from Wednesday's broadcast. Also, ESPN announced today it is suspending Grantland, its sports and culture site. It's much loved, I should say, sports and culture site. I'll just quote a tweet from David Leonhardt of the New York Times on this. He is also, I should disclose here, a friend of this show. Quote, I am mostly saddened by the ways that ESPN has decided to retreat from journalism. End of quote. Me too. All right, we're out of here. The Dow off 92 points today, 0.5%. The NASDAQ down 20 points, 0.4%. The S&P 500 off 10 points, 0.5%. For the week, basically meh on Wall Street. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer around here. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We are back on Monday. As always, we'll see you then. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.